Tonight on Coast to Coast, we talk about electronic voice phenomena, instrumental transcommunication as well. Special guest Dr. Stephen Rourke, and this one is next on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Stephen Rourke has lectured on developmental psychology, cognition, theoretical and applied physics, and EVP, electronic voice phenomena. Dr. Rourke proposes best evidence standards in paranormal research, and he leads the way with his conclusive investigation of the enduring Spiracom mystery. Dr. Stephen Rourke has advocated for nearly a decade that the role of science should be to investigate the unexplained, not explained the uninvestigated. I like that, Stephen. I like that indeed. How are you?
Great, George. Good to be here.
You too. Tell me a little bit about your background beyond just what I went through.
Well, I have an academic background. I've got experience as a professor of physics for Loyola College, instructed Masters of Science courses at the university level. I've got undergraduate, graduate, and doctoral degrees, and I'm currently pursuing postdoctoral research in the cognitive sciences, which only kind of sort of overlaps with this side interest that we're presenting this evening. I've lectured on EVP itself, but also developmental psychology and cognition and theoretical and applied physics. So these most recent studies have brought that academic acumen really to bear upon the EVP-ITC mystery and its claims of best evidence in the form of Spiracom.
Now, how did a scientist who deals with hard science get involved in the supernatural end of things?
It was kind of in a roundabout way. It's one of these very serendipitous things. As a child, I had found a book on my grandfather's bookshelf, and reading it as a child, it had these wild claims, and I assumed that this book had to be a work of fiction, and it was, in fact, the book by Peter Bander called Voices from the Tapes, Recordings from the Other World. And so it's about the EVP phenomenon, and it's got these strange characters like Dr. Konstantin Raudova having thousands of documented examples of anomalous voices on tape, and the nod from the Catholic Church giving approval in stark contrast to disapproval to things like Ouija boards. The Catholic Church in this book was giving the nod to mediumship of the tape recorder. So I found all this so strange as a child, I thought to myself, gee, it must be a work of fiction, only to come later years in college, only to come to the realization that EVP was, in fact, a recognized phenomenon, mm-hmm. an anomalous phenomenon in the circles of paranormal enthusiasts.
So you decided, as you got into the degreed end of things and then into your life work, you're going to investigate this stuff.
Yeah, because, you know, a person is only given two choices, essentially, when we do the side picking. You know, it's very intellectually dishonest to either completely dismiss something because it seems outlandish, right? So much of the world is until it's fully understood. And it's equally intellectually dishonest to simply agree with something because it comports with your worldview. So I decided to do neither and engage in testing the evidence. And that's what brought me directly to the Spiracom story, because the Spiracom story is one that purports to present on audio tape documented two-way conversation, not just EVP snippets, to be clear, documented two-way conversation with a deceased NASA scientist by way of a technological device. And those are the claims. And with claims like that and its imminent testability in the way of all those audio tapes of the sessions between the operator of the EVP-ITC device and the supposed discarnate scientist, I figured this made it the perfect case to test those best evidence standards.
I'm looking forward to this tonight, Stephen. You know, you and I parallel somewhat because unlike going into the science end as you did to get these answers to some of these unexplained events, I went into broadcasting with a lifelong interest since I was a kid in broadcasting and the paranormal. But I, Stephen, went into broadcasting so I could talk to people like you who are in the know to fulfill that need that I had, because I figured there's no way I can just pick up the phone and call you, for example, and talk with you about what you're doing and the kind of work you're doing. But if I was in broadcasting, I'd have a great opportunity to do that. So that's the direction I went.
You know, I see your point. It's a really an overarching and very broad one to discuss people's frameworks for understanding the world. And that's really important because I don't necessarily seek to change anyone's heart or mind, just to present the evidence, put it out there in the open forum of ideas about this kind of phenomena, and let folks make up their own mind.
Did you go into this with an open mind? Did you go into this with any kind of biasness? How did you do it?
Well, I have to admit I do have a rational, scientific bent. So, if someone did have a framework for understanding their world, George, let's say like a very spiritual or religious framework, they might be more inclined to adopt a set of conclusions as beliefs that are kind of maybe extra cognitive that they hadn't entirely thought through. But this is the nature of that framework of understanding. It's not to be critical of it. I'm stating a fact. So I have to concede that my framework for understanding the world is skeptical, but not as a debunker. This is
okay. So you didn't go into this to debunk these things. You went into this to find out what they are with a real answer, whatever it is.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, and far from being a debunker, I have spoken on both the problematic aspects of EVP. They're truncated, really very, very brief, that they're open to broad interpretation. These are all the problems with EVP. But I've also lectured on EVP as an extremely compelling data set that begs for academic interdisciplinary attention to resolve it as an enduring mystery and a phenomenon. So far from being a debunker, I would put me clearly in the skeptic camp, but that is not to say I set out to disprove something. Otherwise, I'd be intellectually dishonest in selecting evidence that fit my worldview. I'd be doing the same exact thing that I'm saying folks have been doing regarding EVP, ITC, and Spiritcom.
Starting next half hour, Stephen, we'll start playing some of these clips that you provided for us, and I'll let you explain them as we go along with them. Give me your scientific interpretation of EVP, electronic voice phenomena.
Well, there are a few different theories out there, so I can share my pet interpretation at the end, but it's best to give everyone some context.
Sure.
So EVP could be, for folks who aren't familiar, just first, a catch-all for EVP. If you understood it as the anomalous appearance of voices on recording medium. And later, these sounds are interpreted as meaningful snippets of speech. That's EVP. And ITC, which is instrumental transcommunication, that's just the broader, overarching area of endeavor where people use technology to explore mystical and ethereal realms. Okay. So with that in mind, EVP itself is that almost two-dimensional aspect of ITC. It's just the voices on the tape or digital medium. So with that being said, clearly EVP sounds that appear to be voices showing up on tapes, let's say, that could be an extension of human potential. I mean, it could be a kind of telekinesis thing, I suppose. That's one possible explanation for it. I admit that strains a given kind of credulity to say that someone could be impressing with their mind the sounds on a tape. Second one could be that it's not so much hauntings or ghosts responsible for these things, but let's say by your interacting in a given environment, almost like an electrostatic cling, this EVP is being played back because of your interaction with a given environment at a given time. Now, it could also be that there's this intelligent two-way communication happening. And Coast has had some folks on like Brendan Cook from GIS, and they appear to be getting probably from as a direct result of their sheer number of EVPs, they have a variety in their data set that shows apparent interaction. So this brings it beyond this idea of just being in a playback of a given atmospheric condition or something that we just don't understand. And then going toward the much more theoretical, but since this is all very theoretical anyway, I suppose it's okay to mention it.
It sure is.
It could be that EVP provides evidence for higher compactified dimensions where, let's say, either post-fourth-dimensional beings, okay, that's a scientific term for dead people, post-fourth-dimensional beings might inhabit and be able to communicate with the lower dimensions, much like the Michio Kaku example of, you know, the carp in the pond wouldn't know of these higher dimensions, and yet we outside of the pond can easily communicate with the fish, you see.
Yeah.
So it would be that same kind of thinking. And so that's my personal favorite, is to pursue that Everett's many worlds interpretation. And then almost on the flip side of that, multiple dimensions, multiple universes coin to explain EVP, is the idea that it doesn't necessarily have to be a string theory kind of interpretation where you've got these many, many, many worlds and everything's always splitting and forking and there's some infinite universes at all times in the multiverse. It could be that these voices, let's say, are coming from smaller, lower compactified dimensions that exist just, you know, millimeters from us. So all this being completely theoretical.
Okay, now, and we'll get into all these, but you do accept the fact that whatever they are and wherever they're from, there seems to be actual sounds that are being recorded that are very unusual. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes, and that's what
it's
makes
not. It's not all fraud. People aren't in their little audio rooms playing around with the tapes all the time. That some of this is real. We just don't know what it is.
Oh, yeah. In fact, if you consider just how many examples of EVP there are, I at one point did a statistical study where, and I just ran out of the ability to document how many are out there. It seems that it would be impossible for all of these to be faked, because the amount of time it takes to consider them among a group and post them on a site, to add to that that someone would be faking them either in real time or before the fact in some sort of a hoaxing operation, it seems impossible, because there are literally hundreds of thousands just on the web. That is to say nothing of those that exist on tapes people haven't found, those that exist elsewhere that people have found and not posted. There are hundreds of thousands of examples of anomalous audio that sounds like speech. And this is an important distinction, though, I will say, because people are, you know, pattern recognizing and sense making creatures, and so sometimes we can, through what's called apophenia or auditory pareidolia, like children see dragons in clouds, we can use this complex pattern recognition system to sometimes believe something isn't there, something is there when it isn't. But that being said, I do think that there's a vast data set of EVPs that demand a hard look.
Can you imagine the headlines here?
Oh, boy.
Scientist believes that EVPs are real. Now, I don't know what the story will say, because we haven't decided yet, nor have we concluded where they're coming from. But the headline alone is worth a major story, Stephen.
Hey, that's really wild you brought that up, because that kind of headline reminds me of the you've heard of the Edison story, right? About the Edison attempt to communicate with.
Yes, I know he was trying to develop a machine for that. Yes,
right, and that's a great example of how a headline and just what you picked up on, how a headline can fuel a mythos that underrides a story that might have reality to it, but the mythology ends up becoming the story.
Yes.
We could address that Scientific American article where it's basically framed as Edison's attempt to communicate with the dead. This article has given rise to the Spiricom project. Again, this Spiricom project, just to revisit that quickly, from the mid-1960s to the early 1980s, research on the development of a technological means of communication. So to be clear, this is not like spirit mediumship or something in the ordinary sense. Technological means of communication with the dead was conducted by this MetaScience Foundation Incorporated. And George W. Meek, the president of MetaScience, who funded, he was the benefactor, he received funding from other sources, but traveled the world looking for answers, ultimately used a lot of his own money on these experiments. He was influenced heavily by this article about Edison's attempt to communicate with the dead. And, of course, it's rational to be influenced by an article like that if you read the subtitle, because you're thinking, hey, if Edison was looking into it, this brilliant man, you know, maybe the rest of us should consider it. And more contemporary things like Frank's Box, which I know you've had details about that on your show.
Yes.
Frank's Box is another kind of telephone to the dead Spiricom-like device that was influenced by this Edison story. In fact, one of the proponents of Frank's Box, his name is Chris Moon, he claims upon the advice of Edison himself, you know, today, his communication through this Frank's Box with Edison, he claims that that there are all sorts of mandates to communication with the ethereal realms and all this. So this single Scientific American article about Edison's attempt to communicate with the dead has given birth to the EVP-ITC movement. Now, I know that there might have been people technically fiddling with devices earlier than that, but I'm talking about the mythology surrounding EVP-ITC. This was a seminal article. However, there's a little problem with the article. Most folks have not gone to the microfiche
right,
and read the actual article. In the article about Edison's attempt to communicate with the dead, a careful read shows that Edison made no such claims. See, in the article, Edison is merely responding, like most scientists do, like your questions about EVP, is responding in hypothetical terms to the reporter's line of inquiry. And a careful read shows that there was no indication, really no reason, to conclude that he was personally engaged in an effort to build a device to communicate with the dead. The impression one gets from the article, by the way, George, is like, imagine a reporter who needs a story, is around.
That's right.
Halloween, yeah. And bumps into Edison on the street, and spiritualism is the fad of the day, and so asks Edison about the potential of an apparatus to communicate with the dead, and so Edison replies.
Yep. He probably said, now tell me, do you think you could invent something like that? And then he ran with it. We'll be back in a moment with Dr. Stephen Rourke on Coast to Coast AM. Boy, they're going to open up the floodgates in Las Vegas. They're going to let you in when you register for the UFO conference, the Crash Retrieval Conference. I'll be there tomorrow. My meet and greet is from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Pacific time. And then off I go to get ready for the program, which we'll be doing live in Las Vegas as well. But they were going to put a limit on how many people they were going to let in on this. And now the doors are open, wide open. You have to register. There's a fee for the conference. So you can go to ufoconference.com, or there's a link at coasttocoastam.com. But come on by. And what we do in these meet and greets is we just open up the phone lines to you, literally, while you're in the audience. But we give you an opportunity to chat with me about the personal things and other things that you don't necessarily hear on the show. And we've had great times. And we're doing this all around the country. We've been doing it now for at least a year. We're going to continue doing it through 2009. But this one's in Las Vegas, and it's tomorrow, so come on by. Yeah, welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Our guest tonight, Dr. Stephen Rourke. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. It is spiricomstudy.com. I'll spell it for you, S-P-I-R-I-C-O-M, study.com. Stephen, let's talk a little bit about Spiricom now and George Meek and how that relates to EVPs, ITCs, if you would.
Sure. Yeah, we provide some context, perhaps. Well, first, it's important to establish Spiricom as central to the study of EVP and ITC because of its nearly mythological status. Also, it's recognized as some of the best evidence out there for afterlife communications, survival of personality after death, because the background of the story is essentially in 1980, William O'Neill, who was working with George Meek of Metascience Foundation, reportedly made contact with a supposedly discarnate being, what they called a deceased NASA scientist named George J. Mueller, using the Mark IV Spiricom device. So when we get into the details of the device, and some of that is important, but it's probably most important at this point to understand that Spiricom itself is attractive to people interested in ITC and EVP for two reasons. One, the claims of Spiricom are imminently testable, because no matter what you think of the documentation, it is a well-documented claim. That is not to make a judgment about the claims, but simply to say that they don't just say they had these communications. There are tapes of these communications. There were audio presentations at National Press Club events where announcements were made about these new possibilities of metaphysics and physics converging through instrumental transcommunication.
Well, now, this device, can you tell us what it looks like, the Spiricom?
You know, I wish I could, but the literature conflicts on what it might look like. We have a description of it where it takes up half room in this.
It's pretty good size.
John Fuller, yeah, it's pretty good size. In John Fuller's book, The Ghost of 29 Megacycles, you might know John Fuller, by the way, because he also popularized the Betty Barney Hill story. But this device is described as very large, and hey, he looks like he's correct, because the pictures we have of William O'Neill at the Spiricom device operating, it's huge. It's taking up an entire wall. And yet, we also have reports of the Spiricom being like a tabletop size, and even a shelf-size unit was given to Sarah Estep to experiment with, and she didn't get similar results at all. But all that being said, I wish I could tell you what it looked like. I can tell you with some degree of certainty what the components were without being too egg-headed.
Okay,
It had these audio oscillators, and there were 13 of them, and that's probably for no mystical reason. It was really just an attempt to approximate the tone range of an adult male voice should a discarnate being, you know, require some approximation of a voice box. It had a radio transmitter and a receiver. Now, it transmitted at 29.57 megahertz. And there was also this other variety of equipment. And so you can understand here conceptually what's going on is there is a transmitter in a room, there's a receiver in a room, and in between those two, there is the operator and these oscillating tones that the operator hopes some discarnate being will use as an audio carrier wave to send messages. There was some other equipment involved, like video readouts and things of this like. Even an artificial larynx device was involved in some of their early research. So that's basically the background on it. You know, there were no real schematics, so there's only so much detail anyone can claim to know about the internal components of the Spiricom. There were only these block diagrams.
All right, we're going to get into some of your research in just a second here, Stephen, but I want to play the first couple tracks that you've provided for us. The first one is George Meek introducing Spiricom. Tell me about that before we play it here.
Ah, yes, and quite importantly, he doesn't just introduce Spiricom. This is from a rare find from the MetaScience archive. So, in other words, what folks are about to hear is not the commonly regurgitated Spiricom quote-unquote evidence. This is brand new evidence from a documentary George Meek participated in, where he not only introduces conceptually what the Spiricom device was, but also introduces the discarnate scientist, introduces him as Dr. Mueller. And then after we know more about Dr. Mueller, claiming he's a NASA scientist with folks working under him at the space program, the track immediately following that will then provide actual audio evidence given to us by the MetaScience organization purporting to be two-way communication with the dead. So track one is just what you said.
Let's listen to it.
In 1981, my colleague William O'Neill and I had more than 20 hours of two-way voice communication with the American scientist, Dr. George Jeffries Mueller. When we talked to Dr. Mueller via electronic equipment in 1981, he had died and been buried 14 years earlier, yet it was Dr. Mueller's astral or etheric body with which we were talking. His superb mind, memory banks, personality, and soul were just as alive as when he had been directing a large staff of scientists in the U.S. space program.
Boy, these old cuts are classic, Stephen, aren't they?
Oh, they really are. It gives you the feel for being back then and how these claims must have appeared to people and how they must have both elicited, I guess, some degree of laughter, maybe even anger from the scientific community, and some excitement from the paranormal enthusiasts at the time.
Okay, now track two, which we'll listen to. This is a Spiricom promotional tape, I guess, right?
Well, yes. Now, I want you to imagine this press club event now in 1982. This is the Washington Press Club, so this is legit. And he has a panel of scientific experts with him from his MetaScience Foundation. And part of the press kit, in addition to a transcript of the entirety of a presentation, is also an audio presentation where George Meek, wove together with his narration some of the more interesting EVP ITC audio clips. Now, mind you, this tape was a 90-minute cassette, and since we're not really going to play the whole 90 minutes, this is about 1 minute long. It'll give you a flavor of the entirety of the cassette with a really good example of the William O'Neill Spiricom George Mueller audio.
Okay.
It was our great good luck to come into a contact with a scientist among the so-called dead who identified himself as Dr. George Jeffries Mueller. He told us where we could find a copy of his death certificate issued in 1967. He told us his Social Security number, and he told us intimate details of his life and scholastic activities at the University of Wisconsin and Cornell University, his instructorship in physics at Cornell, and his top-level jobs in government and industry. His photograph and biographical data are given in our publication entitled Spiricom.
That's much better right there, William.
Yes, sir, I understood, Doctor.
Very well.
Since one of the first rules of science is that of replication, nothing could be more gratifying than to have Dr. Mueller's conversation confirm that we had at last established meaningful instrumental communication with a person who had shed his physical body.
Now, Steve, that sounds like someone who had a larynx problem and they're talking with one of those little voice apparatuses that they hold up to their throat and Adam's apple.
Ah, you are not the first person to say that, but good ear. In fact, there's a Fate magazine article, going back a ways, the first folks to look into the veracity of these claims at the evidential level with the audio was a Dr. David Rivers speech language expert, a linguist and speech pathologist, who was an expert in these sort of devices, you know, the post-laryngectomy folks who needed these devices. He was on the cutting edge at the time. And when he was asked to take a look, or should say a listen, to these Spiracom audio clips, his conclusion was the same as yours. It sounded a lot like an electrolarynx. Now, only later did we come to learn through my investigation that in the rough draft of the Spiracom manual on page 30, it mentions briefly in passing that Metascience itself was in possession of an artificial larynx, an electrolarynx device. And so we'll be able to catch up to David Rivers' claims and even hear some new attempts at replicating the Spiracom audio sound through other devices like that popular kind of Bon Jovi Frampton device. These were all technologies that were available at the time. So people are probably getting the idea that this can be proven as a hoax, which brings us to an even more interesting question. If it was a hoax, and folks will have to decide that on their own, if it was a hoax, for what reason? You know, cui bono? Who benefited? Mm-hmm. It is an awfully elaborate hoax if it was one. So when we walk through the evidence and people make up their own minds, by the end of the program tonight, I hope to walk them through some of the more interesting models that explain the high strangeness around Spiracom, like the perpetuation of the myth itself and all of these hours and hours of audio evidence by way of these Spiracom tapes. Now, speaking of Spiracom tapes, I assured you earlier that that clip, when folks heard the first clip played, that was something not commonly heard because it's from a rare documentary George Meek participated in, and the second clip was from the promotional cassette that went out. Mm-hmm. Well, we also have some newly discovered Spiracom audio, and keeping in mind what you had just said, how it kind of sounds like the oscillations of an electrolarynx device, keep that in mind as you hear the newly discovered Spiracom audio and note the clarity. It's as if the original Spiracom audio, now I know some could say it lacks fidelity because it's from a cassette, and this newly discovered Spiracom audio is from reels, so it could just be inherently more hi-fi. However, the clarity in the newly discovered Spiracom audio shows a whole lot of inconsistencies at the evidential level. You can almost hear where the operator of the device, William O'Neill, is sometimes, well, he sometimes sounds like he's in approximation of an electrolarynx device and is modulating it with his speech and then immediately switches into the Mueller voice like a schizophrenic or someone with a split personality. And while people listen, see if you ever hear an instance when the two voices speak at the same time.
All right, here we go.
No, I just turned the camera, TV camera on, sir.
What did you say, William?
I said I just turned the TV camera on.
Oh, very well.
You never know, doctor.
Yes, I understand, William. All right, now, very well. Now, let's get on with this. What I suggest, William, is every disregard this audio project.
Audio project?
Yes. In your words, Spiracom, and get on with the television aspects.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I see.
How much better it would be not only to be able to speak, but to visualize the subject you were speaking to. You understand, William?
Yeah, I understand. Just a minute, sir. Just a minute.
Now, Stephen, do you know if Meek was by himself when he was doing these?
Well, actually, that was William O'Neill, the operator.
That was O'Neill, okay.
Of the Spiracom device, and you are correct. He was alone while performing these sessions with the supposedly deceased NASA scientist, Dr. George Jeffries Mueller. So you're correct in your immediate suspicion. If he were alone,
yes,
while doing this, it kind of brings to question some of the veracity of the claims. However, there are videotapes of O'Neill performing these sessions. And then there are also hours and hours of videotape where, you know, he's at the device and the oscillators are going and the 13 tones are resonating in the room and nothing occurs for hours and hours. But there, it's punctuated by these instances where he's at the device, apparently tuning, fine-tuning through intuition, his self-proclaimed psychic abilities, and the instructions of Dr. Mueller. But wouldn't you know it, his back is always to the camera.
All right, now tell me a little bit, in the moments we have remaining here this hour, about your research. How do you conduct it? What are you looking at?
Well, I took a primary source documentation approach. It was mentioned earlier how if Spearcom is an enduring mystery, it's important to look at it in an interdisciplinary way. First, you must look at it evidentially and try to bring some standards of research instead of just dismissing it offhand or accepting it blindly. Bring some testability to it. So a big part of what science is replication, and of course even to the point of falsification, which isn't to insinuate that you put fake evidence in as real evidence. What I'm saying by falsifying is you attempt to reproduce something with the technology of the day, thereby coming to a conclusion if it could have been faked. And so that's a big part of the research. There was a huge biographical background piece, so who were the players? What was the mental condition of the mental status of the main Spearcom players? Was there a real Dr. Mueller? You know, these are all important questions that needed to come to bear upon the enduring Spearcom mystery.
But with your investigating, and you said the plans are out, that this thing was almost as big as a room. Is there anybody out there now, besides Frank's box, developing any kind of incredible technology to allow us to do what we need to do to communicate with the dead?
Well, this is what they claim to do, and honestly, I don't know how. Because if they're making Spearcom-like devices, they're basing it on a black box kind of technology. And to make matters worse, the fact that there is no technological transparency to the device itself, because all that's out there is block diagrams, which basically show nothing in the way of electronic circuitry. To make matters worse, the MetaScience Foundation itself in 1985, this is years after they had very little success with the Spearcom. Eventually, they stopped having these sessions.
Stephen, we're going to take this break, and we're going to come right back. Let me ask you about that when we come back. Plus, we've got many more Spearcom tapes here that we want to play.